This is episode 2 of the Serpentine podcast on work. What?
That was so, you're just going,
I was what? Looking, I was looking at on general ecology and I still said on work. This is episode 2 of the Serpentine podcast on general ecology. I'm Victoria Sin, here with Lucia Pietroiusti.
Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Lucia.
Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too. So this is the first time that we're seeing each other since the symposium that you and Filippo Ramos co-curated.
Yes, that's right. So The Shape of a Circle in the Mind of a Fish is a mouthful of a name.
Yes.
For a long, what we're calling a long durational symposium in lots and lots of parts. Mm. The symposium as a whole looks at interspecies questions across human, non-human animal and artificial and vegetal and mineral consciousness. Mm. And we are looking at it each time from a different standpoint. So this one, which was in fact the second symposium in the series, mm-hmm. was subtitled Part 2, We Have Never Been One, mm-hmm. in order to think about questions around interior multitude, swarming organisms, planetary organisms, and so on. Mm-hmm. There was such an amazing energy in the room and so many incredible ideas that got thrown around that I think we're still kind of digesting them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel like it's one of those things where it's really hard to see the whole from like within it, you know? So I guess, you know, now is our opportunity to go through things and unpack them, right?
That's right.
I was thinking as I was sitting through the talks that we're having a bit of a therapy session. It's like a group therapy session. We're all in recovery from the century of the gene, where you had this prime mover that controlled everything that flowed from it, right? And now we get to think about multitudes and layers of relationship and those kinds of things.
That was Hannah Landecker at the Shape of a Circle in the Mind of a Fish Symposium announcing the end of the century of the gene.
Right. So this is something I think about a lot in my work of like, you know, categories and how categories are produced and how they simplify and actually how, you know, like existence and subjectivity and, you know, just like living in the world is a lot more, as Hannah says, like layered and complex and involves multitudes.
And it's amazing. In the rest of the talk, Hannah was talking about how smell or the receptors of smell chemicals exist in different parts of the body that aren't the nose. And so how, and all of a sudden, just all these things that seem clear, like that seem to have an aim that's specific and singular, just kind of begin to break down into this sort of beautiful, messy mess.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like a lot of the symposium was about how to change our like human, you know, need to like simplify to understand.
That's right.
Well, I feel like this really links to Anna Singh's Golden Snail Opera, because these techniques of friendly farming, which kind of consider things that like we don't see or like often don't believe in, like ghosts, you know?
So for context, the Golden Snail Opera looks into friendly farming in Taiwan and was made with a number of collaborators, Yanling Tsai, Isabel Carbonelli, and Joel Chevrier. And it addresses this period in history after World War II where Taiwan was influenced by America and particularly this notion of the Green Revolution, a kind of modernist idea of agriculture where the use of chemicals and pesticides and techniques that industrialized farming in order to maximize production were used. And particularly and very importantly, monoculture, so growing only one crop at a time. Mm-hmm. And we now know that monoculture is incredibly devastating for biodiversity, for species diversity, and for the survival, just the survival of the ecosystem in a place.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, as much competition as it is symbiosis, and like those things are also not even really a binary, right? It's like it's all happening at the same time. So this is the first 12 minutes of the Golden Snail Opera by Anna Singh, performed by Gruff Theatre at the Shape of a Circle in the Mind of a Fish Symposium.
They say that the Emperor Yao, who is now a god in the temple, long ago began the merit-based promotion system for officials in China. Grandpa Chang told this story about him, that when it came time for him to pass his rule to a successor, he passed over his own son to choose Shun, a farmer known for his extraordinary filial piety. Shun was so filial that when he went to the fields, the animals joined his work. Grandpa Chang was talking about a 1950s Green Revolution film on how to use chemical fertilizers and pesticides for the ricing farming in Taiwan. He remembered that during transplanting season in those days, the world was completely silent, without the sounds of animals or birds. And with the coming of a new generation of friendly farmers, the sounds had begun to come back. As they did for Shun, the animals are joining the work. But not all animals support the farmers. Some do everything they can to thwart the harvest.
Perhaps if you've heard of the golden snail. Some call it apple or pomacea canela carta. During the high times of 20th century development, the snail was imported from Argentina to Taiwan as a potential food production project. They called it the golden treasure snail, but nobody would eat it. Abandoned, it spread across the countryside, attacking rice seedlings as its favorite food. This sequence was repeated across Asia. In Southeast Asia, the golden snail threatens wetland ecologies. Native snails dwindle. Everywhere, it consumes the young rice. A poster child of progress again became a dangerous pest. Much has been written by experts on what to do, from deadly poison molluscicides to labor-intensive hand-picking at night. Have you ever wondered how small farmers deal with this rising new pest? Do you imagine they follow the experts or traditional knowledge? Our group found something else. A set of experimental, natural history-based practices in which farmers try out interventions that might change the dynamics of the multi-species landscape. Science, folk religion, tradition, community debate, social media, all are worked together in such experiments. Many creatures are new here, including the snails. Farmers check out how other creatures check out each other. The result is a shifting multi-species choreography.
I came to this place alone, uprooted, and hungry. I had lost my sense of direction. The rain infused me. The river tugged at me. I had no house to rest and no kin to feed me. They called me lonely spirit, wandering ghost. No one noticed me. I crept up behind you until you felt my nudge. Caught you, I cried. But you never heard. I was put out. I tossed the civet cat in front of a car. I swerved that truck into your motorcycle. With all the accidents you noticed, you felt a nagging. You gave me food, clothes, and money. And so I came back into the mud where my bones rested for so long. I discovered a circuit of life to haunt and to possess. If you give me stuff and talk to me, I'll help you out a bit, but don't think you own me. My kind, we're not just with you, we are many. We rise with the rice, but we are also the weed. We are the rasp on the tongue of the snail, and we are the hand of the farmer that removes it from its feast. I'm still hungry. Feed me.
It's a hot day here. Yet, I feel cold air on my neck. Maybe it's sweat, but I think it's the ghosts. Do you know how the old farmers here found them? In the 1950s, those farmers discovered their bones when they improved this area and remade them into fields, and here there were bones. We think they're the victims of the American bombing during World War II, when Taiwan was a Japanese colony. These people were running for shelter to the deep ditch from which this village gets its name. They never made it.
Oh, shit.
They died here in the fields. We don't know who their families are. After experiencing so many traffic accidents, we realized we had to be better neighbors. Old farmers made a temple for their bones, but we new farmers, we've only begun to learn about them. I mean, we still don't know what to sacrifice to them or what kind of currency they spend, but we do our best to respect them. Since it is we who invade their places.
Ghosts. They need to eat, and others too. Snails and frogs, birds and leeches, the vegetables on the bungs and the weeds. The questions the friendly farmers are asking, and our research team with them, have to do with how each of these creatures conducts itself while making a living. How do they interact with each other? Are there differences between newcomers such as golden snails and the old residents? Are there ways to insert one's own goals without exterminating everyone? The farmers are learning, and so are the other creatures who make a living here. We watch them. We work toward privileged angles. We join in. These are our natural history experiments at four levels. The paddy field creatures encountering and negotiating with us and each other. The farmers testing new ways to live in common. The research project of the team, the performative script and film. All this matters at four levels too. First, friendly farming is a response to the high-input, high-output green revolution which dominated agriculture in Taiwan since it was instituted in the 1950s. The Green Revolution segregated crops from ecological communities to make them reproductive machines. Loving the crop meant wiping out everything else. Friendly farmers have tried to bring back wider ecologies in which rice might respond to more than the industrial mandate. Friendly farming's natural history experiments nettle the agro-industrial legacy to open possibilities for more than human livability. Friendly farming is a movement as well as a means of livelihood.
Movement. It flows like drowned souls in the water. Water carries past. It seeps across containment and refuses directions, mixing what comes in and what goes out. Industrial chemicals linger, blended in water, thwarting the best intents. Water is the flow of violence. And the flow of blessing.
What's that? Nothing. Let me continue. Second, those experiments contradict much that social scientists tend to say. Farmers, according to so many of my colleagues, either follow modern scientific knowledge or, alternatively, stick to traditions. The Green Revolution gave us that most unhelpful dichotomy. Lately, it's been updated, but the differences are subtle. Villagers are either part of Western hegemonic science with its one world, or else they practice arts of indigenous ontology. Yilan's friendly farmers can't be dumped into either sack. Some are old farm residents, but some are newcomers from the city with a lot to learn. Some pride themselves on their interest in science, reading professional literature, devising experiments, and designing small-scale engineering, such as traps for snails and electric-powered sluice gates. But these farmers, too, acknowledge the ghosts, learn from the elders, and try their hands at multiple ways of living with paddy-field creatures. nor are they content with prepackaged organic dogmas. They encourage curiosity, alerting each other to the often changing conditions of multi-species paddy life. Third, by attending to paddyfield creatures in an open, experimental way, friendly farmers raise questions about the ontological worlds of non-humans. Not just the forms of being assigned them by varied human perspectives, but also the ontic status of their practical interactions with each other and the world. Such questions rarely arise in the discussion of radical cosmopolitical difference, yet they are at the forefront of friendly farmers' engagements with other creatures. The farmers want to know how they might realign their practices and those of other species. This requires attention to the other's way of noticing and of being. Farmers watch other creatures' performances of livelihood, and so too did the research team, which thought to show you through film. This brings us forth to the research collaboration involving in four bodies the experience of two friendly farmers, two filmmakers, and two anthropologists.
Watch me.
The team has built a performance format for multi-species performances.
Watch me. I am plastic. Your field is my challenge. Those snails' forebears knew another world. But here they watch and learn. They flourish with your seasons, they become anew. In the winter we bury ourselves in the mud for the slow undeath of sleep. When I feel the warmth return, they rise with me and we eat. Young weed, young rice, we take you all. We saw the stems of seedlings and let them topple into the mud. Then we smell our companions and join them in a heap for hours of copulation. We are many. I am the mud. I am the seasons. I am the snail. I am the rice stalk on which they lay their eggs. I do them and I do them in. Notice me. I am the would-be mother calling heavy up into the burning air to offer my pink eggs a home above the waterline where few will touch them. I place those hundreds slowly, one by one. I do not rush. And when she descends, I rest within those masses one day, one week, 2 weeks. I am the tiny snails that hatch, fall, and float, and then eat and eat and eat. I am those tiny snails, and I am not them. I am many. Falling from your field, we are many. What kind of neighbors will you be, you farmers? Who is more fearsome, you or we?
Wow.
Yeah. Something that really strikes me listening back to it is these two kind of like competing voices. You have like this voice of like the person who's like being very kind of like didactic and like explaining like everything that was happening, and then this like mysterious, very performative voice whose positionality we don't know, and is not clearly defined, like, on, you know, very purposefully. Like confusing things, but also like making them murky and also making them more interesting.
Murky. I like this idea of like murky and messy, because in a way the character who is lecturing about friendly farming, you know, could have been Anna, in the sense that it echoes a lot of the structures that Anna describes in terms of, you know, alternative modes of agriculture and so on.
Whereas this other voice is like, I was trying to figure out like what it was, even though obviously it's purposefully, you know, you're not supposed to really know or understand, but it was like, it's the ghosts and it's the snails and it's also just like everything. It's kind of like the voice of like the unknown.
Like the subconscious of everything.
Yeah.
Or the, I don't know, the vibrations of everything.
Yeah.
The fact that it sort of whispers underneath, like water flows, or
I love that moment.
Plants speak.
The water, what was it, like the flow of water, which brings violence and also blessing.
Yeah.
But this is also, I think, what Daisy Hildyard talks about. What does it mean? Not only, you know, this really the question of identity, like a human, an identity within, you know, like social structures, and also, of course, like economic structures. Like, what does it mean to be a subject within this like incredibly complex system.
So this book that Daisy published called The Second Body was like this attempt at imagining that the human individual has two bodies. And she says it's really important to think of them as physical.
Mm.
One of them is the body that we have, that we recognize as ours, as in like contained within, let's say, skin.
Yeah.
And then the other one, she says it is a physical body, like all the extensions of one's existence in an ecological sense outside of ourselves.
Yeah.
The waste, maybe even like the love,
you
know, all of those things are, and she says they have a kind of like material reality.
Yes.
The whole book, and to a certain extent the talk, had this drive towards like, what are the cracks in the experience of the everyday that allow us to see for a minute this thing that is too big to conceive of, but somehow too material not to take into consideration, right?
Yes. So now we have an abridged version of science historian and writer Daisy Hildyard's talk from the symposium.
If I ask you to picture the population of the world, what do you think about? When I think about the multitude like that, I find it hard to see it comprised of things that are busy or alive. So if I picture the population of the world, I don't see a great crowd of activity with maybe a man at the front drilling something and a girl at the back on her skateboard. I see something more homogenous, maybe like a graph or a map. It's static. The mass feels inert, doesn't feel like a life force at all. It would be too much for us to see, even imaginatively, what 7.2 billion people are up to right now, or how the mass of individuals are connected to one another all around the world. In the 19th century, George Eliot makes a similar observation in her novel Middlemarch. If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary human life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heart beat, and we should die of that roar which lies on the other side of silence. Not only is Eliot aware of the limits of human perception, our habit of seeing things as individuals or small social groups, but she also has a sharp sense for why our perception of the spreading detail of the wider population lies beyond us. It's for our own protection, she says. Eliot is quoted in an article by an academic and literary theorist called Bruce Robbins. Robbins has invented a useful term for the experience of global connection through an economy. So, if the population of the world lies beyond human perception, how might we experience ourselves as members of an economy, physically connected to particular people elsewhere? Robbins talks about that thing that can happen when you turn the kettle on in the morning and you become aware as you do so of the fiendish network of humans and other agents that your kettle's plugged into. Robbins' second example concerns a similar agency. You begin putting your shirt on in the morning, you look at the label of your shirt, you think of all the people who were involved in the making of your shirt, you think about the conditions of their lives, and the punchline is you just put the shirt on and get on with your day. So Robbins describes this momentary experience of the self as a moment of insight accompanied by a surge of power. In thought, at least, you are launched on a one-click leap from the tender, drowsy privacy of early morning at home, the shirt not yet on your back, the first cup of tea just finished, to the outer reaches of a world economic system of notoriously inconceivable magnitude and interdependence. The words I notice here are magnitude, this is something big, and interdependence, this is something relational, something whose different parts could not exist without one another. Robbins wants to give all this a new term, or he proposes it. He says it's suggestive and provisional. He draws on Immanuel Kant's description of the sublime as a feeling of the inadequacy of the imagination for presenting the ideas of a whole wherein the imagination reaches its maximum and in striving to surpass it, sinks back into itself, by which, however, a kind of emotional satisfaction is produced. So Bruce Robbins wants to call this intense, fleeting experience of being embedded in a network of economic relationships at least from the perspective of the wealthy, the sweatshop sublime. What he's really interested in is the upshot of this experience. Nothing actually happens. The private individual experiences a flash of insight into a vast body and then gets dressed and makes the tea and gets on with their day. In other words, we all understand that suffering is a function of our interconnection, but we go on doing what we do. So we have Eliot suggesting that the human failure to have some kind of overview of societal relationships is in some sense a form of self-protection, a way to go on. And then we have Bruce Robbins proposing that short insights into a self as part of an economy are pleasurable, if not maybe even a little bit sexy, as that Kantian phrase, the production of emotional satisfaction, is sometimes read. Robbins describes a certain desire to live with the voices inside our heads. Let's move down to a collective that a human can actually see. The Real Madrid Stadium can contain a precise multitude of 81,044 spectators, most of whom for the duration of the game are of one mind. When Philippa and I first talked about this conference, we somehow ended up talking about a documentary about the footballer Zinedine Zidane, and the conversation reminded me about a strange thing Zidane says in this documentary, strange and beautiful, I think, about his experience of being surrounded by the crowd. When you are immersed in the game, you don't really hear the crowd. You can almost decide for yourself what you want to hear. You are never alone. I can hear someone shift around in their chair. I can hear someone coughing. I can hear someone whisper in the ear of the person next to them. I can imagine that I can hear the ticking of a watch. This connection with the multitude seems to involve tuning into different frequencies, drawing out some sounds from the crowd, as though they were notes from a single instrument. In fact, the terms are quite similar to those of George Eliot. He's able to hear unlikely sounds, like the grass growing or the squirrel's heart beating. And the experience is auditory. It's that of what we hear. We call, also using an auditory metaphor, tuning in. This is quite unusual, I think. Almost all our metaphors for perception, including the word perception, are visual. Humans are often described as a visual species. So I didn't quite know what to make of this coincidence. Why are they both talking about sound? They're both describing these experiences in unusual auditory terms. But I would suggest that it's partly because sound is a sense that can involve a conscious experience of tuning in and out. Background noise is a constant presence. When I tune into the background of other senses, I rarely notice anything new. So I haven't really looked at the chairs here tonight, but it's not news to me to find out that they're black. Similarly, you don't tune into your touch and discover that the chairs are padded. You don't tune into your taste and discover that there's a biscuit in your mouth. When I tune into background noise, in contrast, I might actually be surprised by something in my near or remote presence. You might hear the neighbor's dog barking. You might hear an ambulance siren. And when I was in the audience earlier on, I noticed that you really can hear one another shifting in our seats if you tune into it. I didn't notice it beforehand. So this is relevant in that Zidane's experience of the crowd and Eliot's experience of human society are like background noise. They both involve the distinction of things which really do exist, but to which consciousness generally remains oblivious. Squirrels' hearts do beat, and Real Madrid's fans occasionally shift in their seats. None of this is happening especially far away from Eliot or Zidane. And yet the connections feel somehow counterintuitive. It sounds a little bit magical, doesn't it? They're removed from everyday experience. The experience of them can only come in occasional flashes, as with the sweatshop sublime. Any perception of a self as something multiple or relational is always coming up against centuries of culture wherein I see myself as an individual. And to say that someone is an individual is often seen as a good thing. So there's culture, and there is also the possibility that there is something more essential to the experience of the self. as singular. I'll come back to this. So maybe it's necessary for a person to use artful structure or imaginative extension to reach beyond that singular experience. We know that our bodies are secured in networks that extend all over the world, and that those bodies are comprised of non-human beings in many ways. But I expect that most of you still feel that you're here in this room, alone with your thoughts in some sense. The article on the sweatshop sublime is interesting because of its relationship with this sense of I-ness. As we've seen, Bruce Robbins is describing this feeling of privacy we have in our own homes early in the morning, just as we might feel securely and personally in our bodies in this room. We talk about being alone with our thoughts, as I said, and few of us seriously think that digestive microbes or textile workers in Bangalore are present in our thoughts. We are not listening to what we're thinking. This is the feeling which gets breached when Robbins describes the sweatshop sublime as a desire for other voices in our heads. These voices enable Robbins, as an academic, to enter the private sphere, the kitchen and the bedroom. Robbins describes a communion with privacy as part of his intellectual task. I've recently come across an expression of something similar in another essay by a literary critic called Timothy Clark, who talks about breaching decorum as a critic. So, inspired by, if not directly following, these ideas of breaching decorum and communing with privacy, I thought that if I'm going to dwell on the idea of the individual, I should try to address my own personal experience in a way that would usually probably make me feel quite embarrassed, even if I wasn't in front of a room full of people. Personal embarrassment is surely one of the most individual experiences you can have. And the assumption of individuality is that my own experience of being an individual is the only experience of the individual that I can have. So I tried to think about times when I've felt myself an isolated, singular being, something that creates problems for this idea that is important to me of dispersed or relational or multiple self. And one experience that came to mind, which Lucia mentioned earlier, was the experience of pain. I want to talk about individual pain. There are certainly rare examples of sympathetic pain, and there are discussions of the cultural constructed nature of pain. But most of us would probably say that we experience our own pain in person. I'm talking about the physical sensation rather than a traumatic experience. If you bump your head, you don't expect anybody in the vicinity to feel your headache. Your headache tells you that you're very much trapped in your own head. If pain is something I experience as myself, it immediately seemed weird when the first thing that came to mind when I thought about what was a prolonged, sustained experience of pain was childbirth. The physical experience of a human body separating into two people. When I was pregnant for the first time, my mother-in-law very kindly gave me one of those pregnancy debunking myth books written by a journalist from The New Scientist, the one which kind of summarizes research studies that tell you how much alcohol you actually can drink without killing your baby, etc. So my book had a pet section on the pain of labor, in which several research studies had compared labor pain quantitatively against other sources of severe pain, like having a limb amputated. It told me, if I remember correctly, that losing a limb without anesthetic was comparable, and that labor indeed compared favorably with the early stages of a degenerative illness. I'm not sure how useful this information was. At around the same time, my cousin sent me a link to an article in a tabloid newspaper about a woman who gave birth while she was in a coma. My cousin said in the email, "See, you don't even have to bother. The baby will do it by itself, so I don't know what they're making a fuss about." Since then, I've noticed this article or similar article come up quite a lot. And I think that what's interesting about this is not the fact of its physical reality. Clearly, it happens. But the fact that it seems newsworthy to us. This highlights the extent to which we seem to believe that labor is a function of the mother's personal consciousness. Before and during labour, I have to say that I did not find the scientific models of pain experience very useful. But I did think about that woman in her coma. I found it quite useful while giving birth to think of it as something that my body and the baby's body were doing rather than something I was making happen, something which was my personal responsibility or project. This may be an indication that I'm physically quite a lazy person, but labour was certainly more often described to me as an effort of personal will rather than a physical process involving two bodies. So the experience of pregnancy can act as a bridge between interconnection and intra-connection. I'm going to move inside the body now, away from my individual consciousness, towards the multiple again, to the hosts of microbial species, which can be said to make up a human person, as we've been discussing. A couple of years ago, I did a residency at the Jena School for Microbial Communication, a microbiological research institute in Germany. I interviewed a professor of microbial ecology. One of the things that I noticed when I interviewed this man was how he spoke interchangeably of I and we when he was talking about his research. This was because he works in teams with students and colleagues. But this shift from the singular to the plural pronoun is also being used in a wider sphere to describe the experience of being more than singular. This is the poet Eileen Miles on choosing the pronoun they. For me, it's just acknowledging that I experience myself as a multiple. It feels like something I can ask for and do. Looking more closely at the Miles quote, we can also see in the second part an acknowledgement that pronoun choice is relational rather than factual. It is a question of address. If it is something you can do, it is something you have to ask for. An addresser always needs an addressee. They need one another. I have heard people express unwillingness to call others by the plural pronoun because it's ungrammatical. And it does sound weird to most ears, including mine, when applied to things that we think of as being done by one person. For example, they gave birth to their daughter on the sofa. You have to do some kind of semantic rearrangement to process that phrase. But we could easily reverse this, I think, to look at how the grammatical convention of individualizing the person leads to a particular conception of experience. So we started with experiences wherein being an individual is immediate and intuitive, and the sense of a multiplied or dispersed self is an occasional epiphany, which occurs briefly before you come back into your body and put the kettle on. We've worked our way through shrinking connections down to a place at which the reverse appears to be true. Language or conventions guide the person into an experience of singularity, or to use a more loaded term, alienation, away from something which is simple and immediately apparent. In Zidane's words, you can almost decide for yourself what you want to hear. Returning to the previous example, to refer to a woman in labor by a singular pronoun may be grammatical, but speaking very literally, it's obviously wrong. If you really are one individual body, you're not in labor. Thank you.
I loved this talk.
Yeah, I mean, I was really struck by this description of the sublime as our imagination's attempt to surpass itself and then kind of like collapsing in on itself with the impossibility accompanied by like a feeling of emotional
satisfaction.
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of brutal. It's a brutal notion. There is a fundamental problem between like the capacity of the brain to conceive of things that are incredibly vast and mm-hmm. complex or incredibly small and quantum level or whatever. That is limited. Mm-hmm. But I've never read a poem about love, had a like pre-perceptive, intuitive feeling of what love was, and then had some paranoid fit that love was way too complex for me to get it and therefore gave it up. Like, no, that's why there's poems, right? I don't know. Like that there are methods that make incredibly complicated things more sensible.
Yeah, definitely. And it has a lot to do with, you know, like intuition rather than kind of logic, even though, of course, logic is, you know, important. As Stacey mentions, language is something that, through grammatical conventions, individualizes constantly through singular pronouns. We are one person, not multiple people. And that's something that often people have difficulty when being introduced to non-binary pronouns.
So in a certain sense, resisting those forms of individualization and the ways in which language can be a tool of control or violence.
Definitely. But I mean, yeah, I think about language a lot in my work. And, you know, like, language is something that has, like, developed and was shaped and, like, created English, especially through, like, systems of power, of patriarchy, of colonialism, of capitalism, of course. So, like, of course, they, like, individualize and reproduce, like, systems of power.
Yeah, and speaking of power.
And speaking of power, why don't you tell us about the next series of podcasts?
So the next 8-part series that we're going to do as part of the Serpentine podcast is dedicated to power in all of its different forms, from electricity to fight the power.
So we're back in the studio in March because we are taking a holiday in February.
In the meantime, there's a lot of amazing colleagues at the Serpentine who are working very hard on lots of new projects. Mm. And so we'll be releasing some of that on your feeds.
Amazing. Okay, so we're holiday in Feb, beach holiday, power in March. But then what about general ecology, Lucia?
Well, general ecology will never end.
Hopefully.
So being as it is, this wide project within which this very long symposium series is taking place, we are planning the next symposium, The Shape of a Circle in the Mind of a Fish, Part 3, for May. But we're also dedicating the whole research of the General Ecology Project and all the other events that are part of the project to plants and plant intelligence and sentience. And we're doing an event on plant sex.
Mm.
And what we decided to do was we'll be releasing episodes on general ecology here and there, peppered amidst the other long series we do.
That's how I like my podcasts, peppered.
Spicy.
Thank you for listening to episode 2 of the Serpentine podcast on general ecology. I'm Victoria Sin, and this podcast was produced by Jesse Lawson for Reduced Listening. Thank you to Anae Lockwood, Vivian Kakuri, and Yena Sutella, whose sound works have all been featured in this podcast. Thanks, and see you in March.